Chapter 8 The Western Three Seas. A quote from Ingensis, the third analytic of men. Complexity begets ambiguity, which yields in all ways to prejudice and avarice. Complication does not so much defeat men as arm them with fancy. Late Spring, 20, New Imperial Year, 4132, Year of the Tusk. Nansurium, somewhere south of Momen. In Gilgath, two thieves assailed him, and the White Luck warrior watched them scuffle, drunk and desperate, with the man who was their doom. They lurched out of alleyway shadows, their cries choked to murmurs for fear of being heard. They sprawled dead and dying across cobble and filth, the one inert, the other twitching. He wiped his Selucaran blade clean across the dead one, even as he raised the sword to counter their manic rush. He stepped clear of the one who stumbled, raised his blade to parry the panicked swing of the other, the swing that would notch the scimitar's honed edge, as thin as an eyelid. The notch that would shatter his sword, so allowing the broken blade to plunge into the Aspect Emperor's heart. He could even feel the blood slick his thumb and fingers, as he followed himself into the gloomy peril of the alley. Unholy blood, wicked beyond compare. No one noticed him in the subsequent hue and cry. He watched himself slip unnoticed through the gathering crowds of onlookers. Even in these lawless times, the murder of two men was no small thing. He followed himself through the ancient, impoverished maze that was Gilgath. One of the priestess beggars called, "You! You!" as he passed a foolery. He saw her sob for joy a million times. The slave plantations were more severe in their discipline, more grand in extent in the lands he subsequently crossed, following his following. He watched himself lean so that he might draw his bloody hand across the crowns of surging millet and wheat. Across the span of ages, the goddess watched and was pleased. And it was good. He came across a cow calving, and he knelt into his kneeling so that he might witness the mother made manifest. He watched himself draw his fingers through the afterbirth, then redden the lobes of his ears. He found a fugitive child hiding in an overgrown ditch, watched himself give all that remained of his food. "There is no greater gift," he overheard himself say to the wide brown eyes, "than give unto death." And he caressed the dark tan cheek that was also a skull decaying between grass and milkweed. He saw a stork riding invisible gusts across the sky. He walked, forever trailing the man who walked before him, and forever leading the one who walked behind. He watched his form, dark for the brilliance of the sun, sink over cultivated summits, even as he turned to see his form, dark within its own shadow, rising from the crest behind. And so he stepped into his stepping, walked into his walking, traveled into his journey, a quest that had already ended in the death of the false prophet. Until at last he paused upon a hill, and for the first time gazed across the walls and streets he had seen innumerable times. Momen, the home city, great capital of the new empire. He saw all the lanes he had never traveled. He saw the temple Zathe, with its famed domes, heard the riotous cries that would shiver its stone. He saw the imperial precincts along the seaward walls, the campuses hazy and deserted. He saw the piling of structure and marble beauty that was the Endymion Heights, his eyes roaming until they found the famed veranda behind the Aspect Emperor's throne room, where the gift of Yatwer glimpsed himself peering back, the Holy Emperor's beside him. Momen. Why should it trouble a mother to see her child love himself so? Inrilatus said from his shadow. He exhaled a breath pent in hungry pleasure. Fondle himself. Sunlight streamed through the cell's one small window, drawing a fan of illuminated surfaces from the smoky gloom. A stretch of her son's hair, the outer lines of his left shoulder and arm. Thankfully, she could not so much see him masturbate as infer it. She fixed him with a mother's flat gaze. Perhaps it was her old life as a whore, or perhaps he had simply exhausted her with his antics. Either way, she was unimpressed. There was very little Enrilatus could do that would shock or dismay her any more. A small carpet had been laid across the floor, with an oak chair, cushioned and elaborately carved, set upon it for her comfort. White-clad body-slaves stood ready to either side with wicker screens, shields, really, ready to shelter her if her son decided to begin pelting her with feces, or any other fluid that caught his fancy. It had happened before. After they were done, she knew, the chains would be drawn to fix her son across the wall, and the attendants would scour the floor looking for anything dropped or forgotten. The boy, a young man now, was simply too ingenious not to devise tools for some kind of mischief. Once he managed to make a shiv, which he used to kill one of his attendants, using only the fabric of his tunic and his seed. "I want Mathanet brought here. To you." She could feel him peering into her face, the strange tickle of being known. She experienced some sense of exposure with almost all her children by Kellis, but it differed with each one. With Caeudis it simply seemed to render her irrelevant, a problem easily dismissed or solved. With Serwa, it raised her ire because she knew the girl could see the pain she caused her mother and yet chose to ignore it. With the Liapa, it was simply a fact of the time they spent together, and a convenience as well, since it allowed the girl to more completely subordinate herself to her mother's wishes. But with Enrilatus, it always seemed more profound, more intrusive, somehow. Like the way she felt in her husband's eyes, only without the sense of resignation. "Uncle Holy," he said. "Ye—" "They smell it on you. You know," he interrupted. "Fear?" "Yes," she replied in a long breath. "I know." Kellis had once told her that Enrilatus's soul had been almost perfectly divided between the two of them, his intellect and her heart. "The Dunyane have not so much mastered passion," he had explained, "as snuffed it out. My intellect is simply not robust enough to leash your heart. Imagine bridling a lion with a string." "You are blackened by father's light," the adolescent said, his voice straying across resonances only her husband used. "Rendered pathetic and absurd, how could a mere whore presume to rule men, let alone the three seas?" "Yes, I know, Enrilatus." What was the power that a mother wielded over her son? She had watched Enrilatus reduce her flint-hearted generals to tears and fury. Yet for all the cutting things he had said to her, for all the truths, he managed only to increase her pity for him. And this, it seemed to her, kindled a desperation in him, while rendering her a kind of challenge, a summit he must conquer. For all the labyrinthine twists of his madness, he was just an anguished little boy in the end. It was hard to play God in the eyes of a heartbroken mother. Enrilatus grunted and huffed air. She tried to ignore the strings of semen that looped across the oblong of sunlit floor several paces from her feet. He was always doing this, marking the spaces about him with his excretions. Always staining, always defacing, always desecrating, always expressing bodily what he sought to do with his mastery of word and expression. All men gloried in transgression, Kellis had told her, because all men gloried in power, and no power was more basic than the violation of another's body or desire. Innumerable rules bind the intercourse of men, rules they can scarce see, even if they devote their lives to the study of Jeanne. Our son lives in a world far different than yours, Esme. A visible world, one knotted and stifled and choked with the thoughtless customs we use to pass judgment one upon another. "Aren't you curious?" she asked. Her son raised a finger to his mouth. "You think father left the empire to you because he feared the ambition of his brother? So you suspect Uncle Holy of treachery? You want me to interrogate him? Read his face?" "Yes," she said. "No, this is simply the rationale you use. The truth is, mother, you know you will fail. Even now you feel the new empire slip from your grasp, topple over the edge, and because you know you fail, you know Mathanet will be forced to wrest the empire from you, not for his own gratification, but for the sake of his brother." And so the game began in earnest. "You must be forever wary in his presence," Kellis had warned her. "The truth will be his sharpest goad. He will answer questions that you have never asked, yet lay aching in your heart nonetheless. He will use enlightenment to enslave you, Esme. Every insight you have, every revelation you think you have discovered, will be his." Thus had her husband, in the course of arming her against their mad son, also warned her against himself, as well as confirmed what Achaemenion had said so very long ago. She leaned forward, braced her elbows against her knees to watch him the way she had when he was but a babe. "I will not fail, Enrilatus. If Mathanet assumes my eventual failure, then he's mistaken. If he acts upon this assumption, then he has broken the Aspect Emperor's divine law." Enrilatus's chuckle was soft, forgiving, and so very sane. "But you will fail," he asserted with a slaver's nonchalance. "So why should I do this for you, mother? Perhaps I should side with uncle. For in truth, only he can save father's empire." How could she trust him? Enrilatus, her and her husband's monstrous prodigy. "Because my heart beats in your breast," she said, out of rash maternal reflex. "Because half of your madness is mine." But she trailed, troubled by the way Enrilatus could, merely by listening, reveal the falsehood of sentiments that seemed so simple and true otherwise. A jerk and rattle of iron chains. "Things heave in me, mother. Be quick. Because I know you want the empire to fail." His laughter was curious, as though crazed forces sheared the humor underpinning it. "And you will trust what I tell you," he said, his voice cracked by inexplicable exertions. "The words of a madman?" "Yes, if only because I know that truth is your madness." A kind of jubilation accompanied these words, one that she immediately repented, knowing her son had already seen it, and fearing he would deny her for simple perversity's sake. Even as a young child, he had always sought to quash whatever was bright within her. "Inspired words, mother." His tone was thin and blank, almost as if he mocked his older sister, Thaliopa. "The very kind father has warned you not to trust. You cannot see the darkness that precedes your thoughts, but unlike most souls, you know it exists. You appreciate how rarely you are the author of what you say and do." He raised his shackled hands for a clap that never came. "I'm impressed, mother. You understand this trick the world calls a soul. A trick that can be saved or damned. What if redemption was simply another form of damnation? What if the only true salvation lay in seeing through the trick and embracing oblivion?" "And what if," Esmenet replied, with more than a little annoyance, "these questions could be debated endlessly without hope of resolution?" In a wink, Thaliopa's manner had vanished, replaced by a hunched ape, leering and laughing. Father has been rubbing off on you. Perhaps she should have been amused. Perhaps she should have been, despite the utter absence of trust. But her heart had been bludgeoned, her hope battered beyond the possibility of amusement. "I tire of your games in Rilatus," she said, speaking a fury that seemed to gather strength in the sound of her voice. "I understand that you can see my thoughts through my voice and face. I understand your abilities as well as anyone without Dunyane blood can. I even understand the predicaments I face in merely speaking to you." More laughter. "No, Mother, you most certainly do not understand. If you did, you would have drowned me years ago." She fairly leapt to her feet. Such was the sudden violence of her anger. But she caught herself. "Remember, Esme," Kellis had warned her, "never let your passions rule you. Passions make you simple, easy to master. Only by twisting, reflecting upon your reflections, will you be able to slip his grasp." Enrilatus had leaned forward from his hunch, his face avid with a shifting melange of contradictory passions. A face like a pick, sorting through tumblers of her soul. "You lean heavily on Father's advice," he said, his voice reaching for intonations that almost matched Kellis's. "But you should know that I am your husband, as he really is. Even Uncle, when he speaks, parses and pitches his words to mimic the way others sound, to conceal the inhumanity I so love to flaunt. We Dunyane, we are not human, Mother, and you are children to us. Ridiculous and adorable, and so insufferably stupid." The Blessed Empress of the Three Seas could only stare in horror. "But you know this," Enrilatus continued, his gaze fixed upon her. "Someone else has told you this. And in almost precisely the same words."
"Who?" "The wizard. The legendary Drusus Akavian."
"Yes. He told you this in a final effort to rescue your heart, didn't he?" "Ah, Mother! I see you so much more clearly now. All the years of regret and recrimination, torn between terror and love. Stranded with children. Such wicked, gifted children. Ones you can never hope to fathom. Never hope to love. But I do love you. There is no love without trust, Mother. Only need. Hunger. I am a reflex, nothing more, nothing less." Her throat cramped. The tears welled to her eyes, spilled in hot threads across her cheeks. He had succeeded. At last he had succeeded.
"Damn you," she whispered, swatting at her eyes.
Battered and exhausted, that was how she felt after mere moments with her son. And the words, what he had said would torment her for nights to come, longer.
"This was a mistake," she murmured, refusing to glance at his lurid figure.
But just as she turned to signal the slaves to leave, he said, "Father has cut off all communication." She slumped in her seat, breathing, staring without focus at the floor.
"Yes," she said.
"You are alone, lost in a wilderness of subtleties you cannot fathom."
"Yes."
At last she raised her gaze to meet his. "Will you do this for me, Enrilatus?" "Trust. Trust is the one thing you seek."
"Yes, I..."
A kind of resignation overwhelmed her. "I need you." Invisible things boiled through the heartbeats that followed. Portents. Ruminations. Lusts. "There can only be three of us," Enrilatus finally said. Once again, unnameable passions creaked through the seams of his voice.
The blessed Empress blinked more tears, this time for relief.
Of course, just your uncle and myself.
No, not you. My brothers. A heaving breath swallowed his voice.
Brothers?
She asked, more alarmed than curious.
Kel, he said with a bestial grunt. And Sammy.
The Holy Emperor stiffened. If Enrilatus had been seeking a fatal chink, he had discovered it.
I don't understand, she replied, swallowing. Sammy is... Sammy, he...
But the figure she spoke to was scarce human anymore. And as Serimber Enrilatus rose with a dancer's slow deliberation, then threw himself forward, his arms and legs outstretched, straining against the limits of his chains. He stood there, all spittle and squint-eyed passion, his naked limbs heaving, trembling with veins and striations. Her shield-bearers, Esmond could not help but notice, had shrunk behind the wicker screens meant for her.
Mother!
Her son shrieked, his eyes shining with murder.
Mother! Come closer!
Something of her original imperviousness returned. This was her son as she knew him best. The beast.
Let me see your mouth, mother!
Iothea. The woman called Satma Nanafiri was brought before the Padi Raja and his loutish court, the same as all the other notable captives, stripped naked and shackled in iron. But where other attractive women had been greeted with lascivious hoots and calls, humiliation, Malawebe had realized, was as much a part of the proceedings as the Padi Raja's judgment. A peculiar silence accompanied Satma Nanafiri's short march to the floor below Fanayo. Rumors of this woman, the Bimayu sorcerer decided, had spread quickly among the desert men. The fact that he had not heard these rumors simply served to whet his curiosity, as well as to remind him that he remained an outsider. Fanayo had seized one of the few temples not burned, a great domed affair that abutted the Agnotum market, the ironic point of origin for many luxury goods that found their way to Zeum. The altar had been broken down with sledges and hauled away. The tapestries with panels drawn from the tractate and the chronicle of the Tusk had been burned. Those representing the First Holy War, Malawebe was told, had been carted out of Iothea to line the horse stalls seized by Fanile's growing army. The frescoes had been defaced, and graven images everywhere had been smashed. Several green and crimson banners bearing the twin scimitars of Fainimri had been roped and tacked across the walls. But the tusks and circumfixes were simply too ubiquitous to be completely blotted. No matter where his eyes strayed, along the columns, over the cornices and vaults of the flanking architraves, Malawebe glimpsed unscathed evidence of the Aspect Emperor and his faith. No more so than the dome itself, whose height and breadth were alone a kind of miracle to Malawebe, hailing as he did from a nation without archers. A great wheel of frescoes hung in the high gloom above the unbelievers, five panels representing Inri Sejanus in some different pose, his face gentle, his hands haloed and painted gold, his silvered eyes glaring endlessly down. Fanile's desert grandees betrayed no discomfort that the second negotiant could see. But then Malawebe always found himself surprised by men's general blindness to irony and contradiction. The Kyanine had looked vicious and impoverished before. They looked positively absurd now, decked in the eclectic spoils of a great imperial city. The desert mob seethed with jarring mixtures of clothing and armor. The high conical helms from Anon, black thunieri hauberks, a couple of silk gowns that Malawebe suspected belonged to a woman's wardrobe, and in one case, the baggy crimson pantaloons typically worn by caste slave eunuchs. One man even sported a Nilna meshi feather shield.
Most of them, Malawabe knew, had spent the bulk of their lives hunted like animals across the desert wastes. Until now, they had counted sips of water and shelter from sun and wind as luxury, so it made sense they would feast in all ways possible, given the crazed rewards fate had heaped upon them. Even still, they looked more carnival of dangerous fools than a possible ally of the high, holy Zeum. Once again, Fanile alone embodied the elegance and reserve that had once distinguished his people. A wooden chair had been set behind the forward ridge of the altar's shattered base, where the Padaraja sat, agleam, even in temple gloom, wearing a cult of golden mail over a white silk tunic. The armor and uniform of the Koryori, the famed heavy cavalry he had once commanded as a young man during the First Holy War. Meppa stood at his right hand, his cowl drawn back, his eyes hidden as always behind the silver band about his head. The Kisharim's serpent rose like a black iron hook from his neck, testing the air with its tongue, wagging from voice to voice. Malawabe had been assigned the shadows behind and to the left of the Padaraja, where he had watched perhaps 100 naked women and men drag beneath Fanile and his vengeful whims, a piteous train of them, some proud and defiant, but most abject and broken, wheezing and weeping for a mercy that was never shown. The captive men, no matter what their station, were asked whether they would curse their aspect emperor and embrace the truth of the prophet Fane. Those who refused were dragged off for immediate execution. Those who agreed were taken away to be auctioned as slaves. As far as the Bimayu sorcerer could tell, the women, the bereaved wives and orphan daughters of the caste nobility, were simply brought out to be divided as spoils. On and on the proceedings continued, becoming more sordid and more farcical, it seemed, with the passing of every doomed soul. Dull enough for an old scholar to ponder the perversities of faith, long enough for an old man's feet to ache and itch. Something about Satma Nanafiri, however, instantly dispelled his boredom and discomfort. The guardsmen threw her to the prayer tiles beneath the Padaraja. But where they had delighted in wicked little flourishes with the others, they did so this time with mechanical reluctance, as if trying to hide behind their function. Fanile leaned forward, petted his braided goatee as he studied the captive. This, too, was unprecedented. "My inquisitor has told me a most interesting tale." The woman slowly pulled herself upright, graceful despite her iron shackles. She betrayed neither fear for her future, nor shame for her captive nudity. But she was not without a certain diminutive beauty, Malawabe thought. But there was a hardness to her that belied the soft brown curves of her skin, and there was something about her posture and her squint that suggested the habits of someone older, far older than her apparent 30 years. "He says," Fanile continued, "that you are Satma Nanafiri, the mother supreme of the Yatwirian cult." A grim and condescending smile. "I am." "He says you are the reason we found these lands of fire when we arrived." She nodded. "I am but a vessel. I pour only what has been poured." Even after so few words, Malawabe knew her for a formidable woman. Here she stood, naked and manacled, yet her gaze and bearing communicated a confidence too profound to be named pride, a majesty that somehow upended the stakes between her and the famed bandit Padaraja. "And now that your goddess has betrayed you?" "Betrayed?" she snorted. "This is not a sum. This is not a wager of advantages over loss. This is a gift, a mother goddess's will. So the goddess wills the destruction of her temples, the torment and execution of her slaves." The longer Malawabe gazed at the woman, the more a weight seemed to press against his brow. Her eyes seemed bright with moist vulnerability, her body fetching in the lean way of peasant virgins. And yet watching her,
An impression of something hoary, hard, and old continued to plague him. Even the downy curve of her sex, she seemed a kind of visible contradiction, as if the look and promise of a virgin youth had eclipsed the sight of a hag, but not the corona of meaning that hung like a haze about it. So even now she glared at Fanial. It seemed something reptilian peered through her peering. The look of something vicious and remorseless with age, flashing from the gaze of a woman, flushed and breathless and so very inviting. "We take such gifts that come," she crooned. "We suffer this worldly trifle, and she will save us from oblivion, from those demons our iniquities have awakened. This is but the arena where souls settle eternity. Our suffering is dross compared to the glory to come." Fanial laughed, genuinely amused, but his humor cut against the obvious unease of his court. "So even your captivity, you think this a gift?" "Yes. And if I were to deliver you to the lust of my men?"
"You will not." "And why is that?"
In a twinkling she became coy and whorish. She even glanced down at her breasts, which were firm with improbable youth. "Because I have been reborn as black earth, as rain and sweating sun," she said. "The goddess has cast me in her image as sweet, sweet fertility. You will not allow other men to trade me, so long as your loins
"My loins?" Fanial cried out with forced incredulity.
Madawebe gazed and blinked. She literally tingled with nubile promise, yet still she carried the air of old stone. Something was wrong.
"Even now," she said, "your seed rises to the promise of soft earth, deeply plowed."
Masculine laughter rumbled through the chamber, only to falter for want of breath. Even old Malawabi could feel a tightness in his chest and a matching thickness crawling across his thighs. With no little horror, the Bimayu sorcerer realized the goddess was among them. There was peril here, great peril. This woman walked with one foot on the outside. He opened his mouth to call out a warning, but caught himself on the very hinge of his voice. He was no friend to these savage people. He was an observer, interpreter. The question was whether Zayum's interest would be served if Fanial were alerted. Ally or not, the fact remained that the man was a fanatic of the worst kind, a believer in a creed, Fainimry, that made devils out of the gods and hells out of the heavens, to strike an alliance that earned the enmity of the mother of birth, would be a fool's exchange. The Zayumi may not pray to the hundred, given their intercessory faith, but they certainly revered and respected them.
"Soft earth deeply plowed," Fanial repeated, gazing upon her form with frank hunger. He turned to the lean and warlike men of his court.
"Such are the temptations of evil, my friends," he called, shaking his head. "Such are the temptations."
More laughter greeted these words. "Your sisters are dead," the Padaraja continued, as if immune to her wiles. "Your temples are pulled down. If these are gifts, as you say, then I am in a most generous mood." He paused to make room for a few frail guffaws from his assembled men. "I could give you a noose, say, or 1,000 lashes. Perhaps I will have Meppa show you what kind of prison your body can be." Malawabi found himself wondering whether the woman had even blinked, so relentless was her gaze. The fact that Fanial weathered it with such thoughtless ease actually troubled the Bimayu sorcerer. Was the man simply oblivious? Or did he possess a heart every bit as hard as her own? Either possibility would not bode an alliance well.
"My soul has already left and returned to this body," she said,
her girlish voice scratched with the harsh intonations of a crone. "There is no torment you could inflict upon me."
"So hard!" Fanile cried, laughing. "Stubborn, devil-worshipping witch!"
Again the desert court rumbled with laughter. "I would not ply your body," Mepis said without warning. So far he had stood silent and motionless at his sovereign's side, his face directed forward as always. Only the asp, which curved like an onyx bow across his left cheek, faced the lone woman. Satman and Afiri regarded the Kisharim with a sneer. "My soul is beyond your devilry, snakehead. I worship the Dread Mother." Never had Malawabi witnessed an exchange more uncanny. The blinded man speaking as if to a void, the shackled woman as if she were a mad queen among hereditary slaves. "You worship a demon." The Mother Supreme laughed with the bitter hilarity. The cackle rang across distant walls, echoed through the high crypt hollows, gelding all the humor that had come before it. Suddenly the assembled men were nothing but ridiculous boys, their pride swatted from them by the palm of a shrewd and exacting mother. "Call her what you will," Satman and Afiri exclaimed. "Demon? Yes, I worship a demon, if it pleases you to call her such. You think we worship the hundred because they are good? Madness governs the outside, snakehead, not gods or demons, or even the god. Fool, we worship them because they have power over us, and we Yatwirians, worship the one with the most power of all." Malawabi squelched another urge to call out, to urge the Phanum to spare her, to set her free, than to burn 100 bulls at Nyatwar's honor. The mother was here. Here.
"Gods are naught but greater demons," the Kisharim said. "Hungers across the surface of eternity, wanting only to taste the clarity of our souls.
Can you not see this?"
The woman's laughter trailed into a cunning smile. "Hungers, indeed. The fat will be eaten, of course. But the high holy, the faithful, they shall be celebrated!" Mepa's voice was no mean one, yet its timbre paled in the wake of the Mother Supreme's clawing rasp. Even still he pressed, a tone of urgent sincerity, the only finger he had to balance the scales. "We are a narcotic to them. They eat our smoke, they make jewelry of our thoughts and passions. They are beguiled by our torment, our ecstasy. So they collect us, pluck us like strings, make chords of nations, play the music of our anguish over endless ages. We have seen this, woman. We have seen this with our missing eyes."
Malawabi scowled. Phanum madness. It had to be.
"Then you know,"
Satman and Afiri said in a growl that crawled across Malawabi's skin. "There will be no end to your eating when she takes you. Your blood, your flesh, they are inexhaustible in death. Taste what little air you can breathe, snakehead. You presume your solitary god resembles you. You make your image the form of the One. You think you can trace lines, borders, through the outside, like that fool Sejanus? Say what belongs to the god of gods and what does not? Arrant abstractions! Hubris! The goddess waits, snakehead, and you are but a mote before her patience. Birth and war alone can seize, and seize she does."
The Bemayu sorcerer glanced out over the festooned court, his attention drawn by gasps and murmurs of outrage. The desert men watched, their faces caught between fury and horror. Several of them even signed small folk charms with their fingers. The oddities had been piled too high for them not to realize something profound was amiss.
"Stay your curses!" Fanile cried, his humor finally beaten into fury.
she cackled in a manner far too savage for lips as young as hers. Dust plumed through a rare shaft of sunlight, starscapes rolling on temple drafts. "Yes, mother!" she shouted to the air, the way Meppa might. "Seizing him would be a delight! Yes!" "Demoness!" the last Kisharam bellowed. He descended the steps toward her, his face held forward as stiff as a doll's. "I know the true compass of your power. You are written across ages, and yet you need tools. Men, and all men can fail. It is the foundation of what we are. You will be broken with your tools, and you will starve in your pit." "Yes," Satma Nanafiri cackled once again. "All men save one."
Meppa lowered his face, as if only now seeing her through the etched silver of his band. "The White Luck," he said.
"White Luck?" Fanal asked.
Malawabi stood breathless in the wake of the question. These Fainim barbarians could not fathom the disaster they courted. "The Hundred. The Hundred rode to war." "There are infinite paths through the tumble of events," Meppa explained to his sovereign. "The White Luck, the idolaters believe, is that perfect line of action and happenstance that can see any outcome come to pass. The White Luck warrior is the man who walks that line. Everything that he needs happens, not because he wills it, but because his need is identical to what happens. Every step, every toss of the number sticks is... He turned back to the fierce glare of the Yatwirian Mother Supreme.
"Is a what?" Fanile demanded.
Meppa shrugged.
"A gift."
The diminutive woman cackled and rattled her chains for stamping her feet.
"You are but a temporary blight, a trial that sorts the faithful from the thieves. A far greater war has seized the three seas. The goddess has broken the yoke of the thousand temples. The cults arm themselves for battle. Ride, Fainim fool, ride, conquer what you can. Death and horror will eat you all ere this ends."
Fanal Ab Kaskamandri raised his hand as if trying to snatch words he had tossed aside.
"So this White Luck warrior of yours," he snapped, "he hunts the Aspect Emperor?"
"The goddess hunts the demon." Fanal returned to his Kisharam and grinned. "Tell me, Meppa, do you like her?"
"Like her?"
the blind man responded, obviously too accustomed to his jokes to be incredulous.
"No."
"Well, I do," the Padaraja said. "Even her curses please me." "So she is to be spared?"
"She knows things, Meppa.
Things we need to know."
But Malawabi, his skin crawling with goose flesh, understood, as did every man present, save perhaps the Kisharam. The bandit Padaraja simply made excuses. For all her provocations, for all her deadliness, Satma Nanafiri remained, as she had said, soft earth deeply plowed. And the dread mother of birth would work her inscrutable will.
Momin. Grief had crippled her. Grief for the death of her youngest, her sweetest, and most vulnerable, Semarmis. Grief for the loss of her oldest, her bitterest and most wronged, Maimara. Anger had saved her. Anger at her husband for stranding her. Anger at her servants for failing her, and for doubting her. Doubting her most of all. Anger and the love of dear little Kelmomus. She had taken to stalking the palace halls those nights that sleep eluded her. Twice now she had caught guardsmen throwing number sticks, and once slaves making love in the Hepatine Gardens. Sin, she knew her husband would have punished, but that she feigned to overlook. Almost inevitably, she found herself padding alone through the cavernous heart of the Imperial Audience Hall. She would gawk as she walked, crane her neck like the caste menial she was, thinking of all the peoples behind the panoply of symbols hanging between the polished pillars. She would climb the dais, run her fingers across the arm of her husband's great throne, then sashay out onto the veranda beyond, where she would gaze across the labyrinthine expanse of her capital. How? How did a low and mean whore, the kind that would sell her daughter in times of famine, become the blessed empress of all the three seas? This, she had always thought, was the great question of her life, the remarkable fact that historians would ponder in future generations. She had been the rut, the track long mudded, and now she found herself the charioteer. There was a mystery and a beauty in great inversions. This was the genius and the power of the circumfix, the paradox of the God Almighty hanging naked from an iron ring. All men are born helpless, and most men simply grow into more complicated forms of infancy. And yet, since they are the only summit they know, they constantly find themselves looking down, even as they grovel at the knees of the mighty. All slaves become emperors, Protathus had written with canny cynicism, the instant the slaver looks away. Her rise, as impossible, as miraculous as it had been, expressed a conceit native to all men, and so the wild anomaly of her life had become a kind of human beacon. For the caste nobility, long used to beating aspiration from their slaves, her mere existence triggered an instinct to punish. For slaves and menials, long accustomed to eating their imperious judgments, her rise reminded them of their daily indignity. But their question was essentially the same. Who was she to be exalted so? This was the real question of her life, the one the historians would never think to ask. Not how could a whore become empress, but how could a whore be an empress? Who was she to be exalted so? She would show them. She had labored tirelessly since word of Iothea's fall had reached her. Emergency sessions with Caxes and Thyril, her home exalt general, as well as the ever-irascible Werejow, prime nascenti of the ministrate. Apparently activity along the Skilvendi frontier, which had surged in previous weeks, had now dwindled to nothing, a fact that at once heartened her because of the redeployment it allowed, and troubled her. She had read the annals, and though Cassidus had died long before the Skilvendi sacked Cannae, she could not but recall throughout that reading how all the far-flung glory he described had been swept away by the people of war. Mercurial, merciless, cunning. These were the words that best described the Skilvendi. She knew this because she had known Nair Urs Sciotha, and because she had raised his son, Moengus, as her own. Though her generals had eyes only for the prospect of avenging their fellows in Shigek, she knew stripping the Skilvendi frontier was a risk, a mad risk. Despite denuding the empire otherwise, Kellis had left 3 crack columns to guard the gap, and for no small reason. But Fenial and the cursed Yatwarians had left her no choice. The plan was to garrison Gadir as best they could, while the Imperial Army of the West assembled at Esgiliok. Hinnereth could be supplied by sea. General Anthyril assured her that they could have 5 full columns ready to retake Shigek by summer's end. Though everyone present understood what Fenial intended, none dared speak it in her presence. The bandit Padaraja had not so much attacked the Empire as her legitimacy. He would suffer for that. For the first time in Esmanet's life, she actually found herself gloating over the prospect of destroying another. and it did not trouble her in the slightest, even though she knew her former self would recoil in horror from such malevolent passions. Fanile Ab Cascamandry would scream for her mercy before all was said and done. Nothing could be more simple. She also met regularly with both her master of spies, Finersa, and her vizier in proxy, Vem Mithridi. She had feared that Finersa, who always seemed brittle for his nervous intensity, would fold under the extraordinary demands she made of him. But if anything, the man thrived. Within a week of Iothea's fall, Finersa had almost entirely rebuilt their network of spies throughout Shygik. When she asked him for pretext she could use to arrest Cutias Bensulla, he had the man imprisoned by the following evening, allowing her to install Beoxysonchus in his place in the Imperial Synod. Likewise, she had feared that Vem Mithridi would literally die, so feeble did he seem. But he too flourished, organizing cadres of schoolmen, students, and those like Vem Mithridi, too frail to participate in the great ordeal, for the defense of the Empire. All the world had thought the Kisharim exterminated by the First Holy War. The stories of their return had sparked a new, almost fanatical resolve in those schoolmen who remained. It seemed miraculous when she paused to think about it, the way her husband's ministers rallied about her. From the outset, she had understood that the greatest strength of an empire, its size, was at once its greatest weakness. So long as its population believed in its power and purpose, an empire could bring almost limitless resources to bear against its foes, be they internal or external. But when that belief waned, its tendency was to dissolve into warring tribes. The very resources that had been its strength became its enemy. This was what made the fall of Iothea so disastrous. Yes, Fanal had cast all of Shygik into lawless turmoil. Yes, he had cut the Western Empire in half. But Shygik was one province out of many, and the links between North and South had always been maritime, thanks to the Great Carathay. Strategically, the loss of Iothea was little more than a nuisance. Symbolically, however, the crisis she faced was a crisis in confidence, nothing more, nothing less. The less her subjects believed in the empire, the less some would sacrifice, the more others would resist. It was almost arithmetic. The balance was wobbling, and all the world watched to see which way the sand would spill. Anisarimber Esmenet had made a resolution to act as if she believed, despite all those who doubted her as much as anything else, and paradoxically, they had all started believing with her. It was a lesson Kellis had drummed into her countless times, and one she resolved never to forget again. To know is to have power over the world. To believe is to have power over men. With belief, then, belief and craft, she would heave on the great chain of empire and haul the balance to the benefit of her children. Esmenet had no more illusions. She understood that if she failed, her sons and daughters would all be doomed. And she simply would not, could not, tolerate another Semarmis. As always, her seneschal, Ngarau, proved indispensable. The longer she had been involved in the new empire's administration, the more she had come to realize that it possessed its own codes and dialects, and the more she understood not only why men such as Ngarau were so indispensable, but also why Kellis, no matter how bloody his conquests, never failed to spare the functionaries of each nation he conquered. Everything required translation. The more fluent the operati, the fewer the misinterpretations, the quicker the findings, the more decisive the Empire's actions. The only wheel she could not turn in concert with the others was the Thousand Temples. But soon, very soon, she would have a resolution to that dilemma. She gazed out across the dark landscape of Momon, slowly stalking the perimeter of the veranda. She had thought about how all the jumbled structures were in fact hollow, how their walls seemed little more than parchment when viewed from so far.
She thought of all the thousands slumbering like miniature, innumerable larvae, soft in their crisp cocoons. And she plotted their survival. We walked the shortest path, her divine and heartless husband had told her the last time she had seen him. The labyrinth of the thousandfold thought. This is the burden the God has laid upon us, and the burden the gods begrudge. Expediency would be her rule, as ruthless as it was holy. Kelmomus, she knew, would be awake and waiting when she returned. He always was, simply because she was so busy she allowed him to sleep with her in her bed, save for those nights she called for Sancus or Inhalus to comfort her. The day itself seemed daring. The wind was constant and thin. The sky was nearly empty. The horizon scraped clean. The Menenor Sea was stone coast dark beneath the sunlight sparkling across its perforations. She sat at a small table with the Liapa at her side, watching the Shrier of the Thousand Temples step from the shadow of the Imperial Audience Hall into the glare of the veranda. Anna Sarimber Mathanet, because of the innumerable golden slivers, tusks woven up and down its length, his white robe twinkled gold with every step. His hair piled high and rich upon his head, the same improbable black as his braided beard. "This is madness, Esme," he called. "The Empire burns, yet you spurn my counsel?" She hoped she looked impressive, with her stark gray gown beneath an ankle-long vest of gold rings. And of course she had her smoke-taste city as her mantle, an intricate modeling of white and gray that reached the horizon. But she was sure it would be her porcelain mask, glazed white with features as fine and as beautiful as her own, that would most weigh against his eyes. "And now you wear a mask? An Anani mask?" She had long pondered how he would begin. Before conferring with Enrilatus, she had thought that he would be conciliatory, that he would use wise and self-effacing words to move her. "Do this, Esme. Confidence awaits." But she had reconsidered in light of what her crazed son had told her. He would affect injury and outrage, she eventually decided, thinking her native doubts would grease his way. And she had been right. "This is about Sherakinth," he continued in the same indignant tones, his voice striking resonances that seemed to warble about her heart. "You think I was involved in her murder?" She did not reply, simply because she did not trust her voice. She could only speak when she felt the cold within her, as the Liapa had instructed. He took the seat waiting for him in apparent fury. Even out of doors the scent of him, myrrh and a kind of musk, bloomed invisible. "Or has the loss—" He paused as if catching himself, but the implication was clear. "Or has the loss of your son driven you mad?" He had not meant, she realized, to say this only to halt out of some compassionate instinct. He had meant for her to complete the thought. Her. Then he could commiserate and slowly pry open her trust the way he had so many times in the past. But she had already decided the path this conversation would take. She peeled a section of flat cake, used it to grasp a pinch of spice-shredded pork. She dipped both into cinnamon and honey, then passed it to him, searching for any sign of hesitation. There was none. He had not extended her any of the traditional greetings or honorifics, so neither would she. "Prius," she said, taking heart in the coldness she felt beneath the clarity of her voice. "Shortly after Carathusel fell, he took me hunting Conti, a kind of antelope, on the Famiri. Have I ever told you that story, Maitha?" He gazed at her with unsettling intensity. "No." The mask tingled against her cheeks. She found herself wondering if this was how skin spies felt beneath the digits of their false faces. Safe.